Hello, and welcome to season two of Career Resilience, where we talk with people about their career path and their career journey, and maybe we can all learn from each other. My name is Jan Daniluk, and I'm a human resources consultant in London, Ontario, Canada. I work with Ford Keist LLP, providing human resources advice and counsel to my business clients. I also support people through individual one-on-one coaching in helping with career development. I hope you will enjoy our series where we talk with ordinary, extraordinary people. We get to hear about interesting journeys. We get to talk with people about failures, successes, advice, and counsel to us as we develop our own careers. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with these people, and I hope you will enjoy listening to it. And now for some logistics. Please subscribe on YouTube, or if you're a listener, please follow me wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a chance, I hope you'll visit my website, career-resilience.com. Welcome. My guest today is John Foreman. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having me, Jan. Great to be with you.
Thank you. Now, I'm going to get right into things. Now, you're a lawyer. You have a boutique law firm that's a class actions law firm.
That's right.
And that's Foreman and Company, which I really like that name. But you have worked in large law firms. You've worked with a lot of students. You've worked with a lot of lawyers. So I wanted to sort of leap right in by asking you, what makes a person decide to be a lawyer, knowing how difficult the job is and knowing that it's basically a 24/7 commitment? How do people get to that decision from what you've seen?
That's a great question. And you touched on something really important in the question, the way you put it. When I think about that, there is the vision that a person has, and then there's the reality. And they are different things. Mm. I think it's fair to say most people enter the law because they see it as a credible profession. They see it as an achievement to have become a lawyer, you know, a professional. There's prestige with it. There's the perception that you earn a good income. All of those things are there. But I have come to realize that it's very difficult for a law student or someone who isn't a lawyer to appreciate all the things that come with being a lawyer, and nearly impossible actually to appreciate those things. And you hinted to the idea that it's a 24/7 demand, and that's true often. But I think there are layers to it that just couldn't be understood until you experience it. And the reality is rarely as good as the vision. And I don't say that to run down the profession, but it's that it really is a hard job. The demands are really significant, and not just the timing demands. It's really, if you're a litigation lawyer, you're a dispute management person for others. And so you are constantly taking responsibility for other people's legal problems, and it's your responsibility to try to solve them. And so the weight of that across a big profile of cases or a long list of clients can be very heavy and very hard to appreciate until you're in it.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think people become lawyers for the reasons I've identified, but I think the reality of it is inevitably quite a bit different. I mean, you can earn a great income, and it can be a very fulfilling profession. You know, if you help people a lot, that feels great. So it all depends on the area that you practice and so on. But I think the visions are there, and they're true to an extent, but there are other parts that come with it that are a lot harder to manage and hard to predict until you're part of it.
Do you think there are certain personalities that are drawn to law?
There are. When I was in university, people used to say, you know, I love an argument. I'm meant to be a lawyer. I don't think that's true at all, that people who are good at arguing become good lawyers. I've seen all types of personalities be great lawyers. And I marvel at that sometimes. I see sometimes very reserved or even shy personalities that are tremendously effective.
Yeah.
So it's sure, I think outgoing extrovert type people that are well spoken and can think on the fly and make quick arguments are good. Mm-hmm. But I've seen all kinds of strengths in other sort of non-traditional personality traits that work really well in the law.
How do you react when you see a show like Suits?
It's fun. It's fun to see. I always love that in the legal television world, the client comes in the door one day and the next day there's the trial. And that never happens in the law. Like, they need to create, obviously, like an introduction to the character and then a resolution in the storyline very quickly. And so the reality is it would be years later before something like that happens in most cases. So I always laugh at that part. But they certainly do glamorize the role, and they do this with every, you know, every show does that. And the medical shows do the same thing.
Yeah.
They sort of glamorize and dramatize the whole situation. But I don't enjoy those shows. Like, my first choice is to watch something about somebody else's profession. Quite frankly, I don't need legal drama for my own entertainment. I live it each day, and so I'll get my entertainment from somebody else's profession.
That makes sense. Yeah. So let's talk about your career journey and you personally, John. How did you get into the law?
My father was a lawyer. He was a criminal defense lawyer and a family law lawyer with a very busy practice and a hard-earned good reputation. Initially, I think I wanted to do other things because in our house, the law was present, and I didn't naturally attract to it, I don't think. And then I can remember in my first year of university, I went past the law school one day walking through Western towards the parking lot near Brescia there. And I remember thinking, oh, that's interesting. And I started to think about what it would be like to study. And I thought about my dad studying at the U of T, that's where he went. And so it started to grow in my head from there. And then I remember by midway through second year, I thought, well, I'm going to be graduating, you know, in 2 years, I've got to have a plan. And so I started to push towards the law. I started to ask my dad more about it. I started to just pay more attention to it. And I got organized, got my marks up a little bit, and wrote the LSAT in my fourth year. And then I got into law school. And so it was a pretty gradual thing over a couple of years. And it was a bit of a turn from where I was in my younger years.
Yeah. What was your undergrad?
I studied psychology with an area of concentration in English.
Okay, that makes sense. That would help in the next phase. So can you talk to me a little bit about what happened in terms of you? Were you thinking of going into your dad's practice in criminal and family?
Yeah, I more the criminal side. So when I was in first year law school, I took a summer job. My dad offered me a position. It wasn't hard for me to get that job, obviously, but he offered me a summer position, and it was really neat because it was his firm, and it meant there were liberties that I could, you know, I was given chances to speak to things in court that maybe I wouldn't have otherwise been able to do. You know, there were all sorts of things that were sort of interesting opportunities for me.
Yeah.
And so I was in court every single day as a first year law student, my summer after first year, which was pretty extraordinary. None of my classmates had an experience like that. And I remember attending bail hearings and traffic court, and I even handled some small claims court trials and things like that. So I was really getting interesting experience without a ton of training, quite frankly. It was sort of these, here's the file, you know, go play with this and see what you can do. And so it was great experience. And in my second year, I think my dad and I were thinking I would practice for him. It just sort of built, the direction built that way, even though I might've been drawn to other things. Your family and your family businesses can be a pull. And so I was, again, working for my dad. And unfortunately, on the first day of work in the summer after my second year, my dad was killed in a car accident. And I was waiting at a court reporting office at a cross-examination when a police officer came to take me back to the office to say he had some bad news. And so everything changed in a heartbeat there. And it was traumatic for my family and I, and the law firm had to be wound up and all these, because I was just a student. I wasn't ready to take it over, obviously. And so it was a real whirlwind at the time. And I remember that the articling application deadline for firms in London was a few weeks away, and I made the decision I was going to apply for some articling jobs in London. So I didn't have a resume because I didn't need one at the time. So I got a resume together and got a cover letter organized and studied up on all the firms and got applications in, and ended up being very lucky because that process went very well for me. I ended up getting a lot of interviews and a lot of offers, and chose a firm that I ultimately articled with and became a partner with before creating this firm, forming a company. So kind of a wild sequence of events, if you think about it.
Yeah. Did it help you that you had to sort of focus on what you were going to do? Because I can't even imagine how you came back from that.
When I think back, I can feel pretty proud of myself because it was traumatic. Like, it was a very sudden, heartbreaking, you know, losing your dad, and then with it having a career path altered at the same time, which is sort of strange, right? Like, you don't normally, you only care about the loss of the family member. And then that was what I cared about, obviously, but I also had other considerations that were immediate, which is, okay, if I'm going to get trained to be a lawyer, I got to secure an articling position because that's a mandatory path that we had to take. And so it went well. And that was, I remember digging deep for those interviews and everything else just to feel calm and, you know, not lose my cool and perform as well as I could. And all of it went well. And by the way, all of the interviewers and the firms, they knew what had happened to me. They knew my dad had died. And so they were excellent. Everybody was wonderful about it and very compassionate about it and everything. Mm-hmm. So all in, it was a bit of an uplifting thing for me in the end that I had opportunities that came out of it that were positive.
So. Yeah, I can't imagine, John, how proud your dad would be of you.
I like to think so too.
Yeah, absolutely. Other than your dad, who were your influencers when you were growing up? What type of people?
My mom was a huge influencer and still is. I had coaches. I was always a track and field athlete. And so I had a number of coaches who were great influencers. And I was lucky enough to have them at each phase. Like when I started running track in high school, I was also part of a club team that was outside of the school. So it was a year-round training and competing system. And I had a coach who was a fantastic guy, and he was a very able mentor. He was the kind of person who could connect and understand what you were going through, what you needed, and what you wanted to talk about in order to make yourself a better athlete. And I always took a lot out of sports. You know, there's a nice connection between work and improvement. Right? You can detect improvement. You can find the connections between putting in effort and getting better results. And so that was really, really huge for me. You know, and the same was true in my undergrad when I ran track at Western. The coaches there remain close friends of mine to this day. Bob Biggers, who's a legendary coach at Western, now retired, was very important for me, as was Vicky Crowley. And Vicky Crowley is now the head coach of both the men's and women's teams at Western. And she's among Damian Warner's coaches, the fellow who just won the decathlon at the Olympics. And she's been contributing as part of his coaching team for years. And that's no surprise to me. So I was lucky enough to have all kinds of great people around that were good influences that way.
Yeah, it feels like sports or any kind of team thing is helpful in terms of what you do later on in your career.
I believe that. I really do. There are other things too. Like, I've seen people who study the arts, they study music. There's a massive discipline in music that translates incredibly well into careers, for example. And so sports is an example of that, right? Where you have to put in time, apply yourself, organize your time. You know, sometimes a physical effort's very demanding in addition to organizing yourself. And so, you know, the track workouts that we used to do, when I think about my time at Western in particular, we would, we'd have a track workout every day, and then track meets on the weekend once the season started. Yeah. And so I remember adding up the hours once, and you'd have to be in the weight room as well. And that was on your own time, in addition to the scheduled workouts and the competitions. And so you could easily have 50 hours a week, in addition to your studies, contributed to sports. And at its high peak, that's what it would be like sometimes. So,
yeah,
you know, it does. It forces you to be really disciplined about your academics and about your physical training, because you sure don't want to put in that time and not get results for it. So those things were really big for me.
Yeah, yeah, just makes sense. Now, Foreman and Company is focused on class actions. So as your type of practice of law, can you tell me a little bit about what class actions are all about?
Yeah. Thanks. That's a great question. It's no secret that our legal system is very expensive and very complicated to navigate. I read a study out of one of the big law firms in Toronto that was released earlier this year that said it is not economically rational to litigate a breach of contract case unless the value of it is more than 300,000 Canadian. So there's a concept there that is really scary, which is that unless your problem is worth 300,000 or more, it's unlikely that you could afford to litigate it individually as a, as an individual. And so that's a big problem in our legal system, that we have that's commercial litigation, that it would be so expensive to litigate a case of any size that you're priced out of the market unless your dispute is worth that much money. And this is an old story. Our legal system has been operating this way for a long time. And so class actions have this concept that if there is a problem, a legal problem that affects many people or many corporations all at once, that's committed by a single company or group of companies, that it can be litigated in one case called a class action. So the idea is aggregated justice.
Yeah.
And the concept there is that those economies of scale that I just described on the $300,000 breach of contract case, you could bring together hundreds or thousands of those cases into one proceeding, and the litigation economics improve massively, right? Where now the case can be litigated economically, probably even without the stakeholders having to pay for it, because it can be litigated on a contingent fee basis, which most class actions are. What that means is the litigation is funded at the risk of the lawyer who prosecutes the case. They agree that they will take, their fees will only be paid if they win, and those fees will be taken out of the recoveries that are driven in the case, typically a percentage of those recoveries. So it has a self-financing aspect where the lawyer takes the risk that the fees won't be paid as opposed to the litigant. So class actions are all about addressing some litigation economic problems that are really prevalent in our legal system. And so you see class actions coming up in a number of areas. You know, consumer law is one where you have consumer transactions that might be worth $5,000 or $7,000 or $10,000 or less per person. And there's a problem with it. Well, class actions tend to be a great way to address claims like that. Shareholder injuries are another one where shareholders have a loss on a publicly traded stock. And that's a result of some misrepresentation made by the issuer of those shares to the public markets that causes a reduction in the stock price and a loss of wealth for the investors. You know, likewise, an individual shareholder would spend just as much litigating as the class action team would litigating the same problem for all shareholders that are affected.
Yes.
So you see these sort of interesting opportunities for aggregated approaches to our justice system. And yep. It makes sense in a lot of ways, and it's something I've always believed in. Class actions, you can't do it in every case. There's a test that has to get met legally, and you have to prove that there's a common group of people affected in a common way by the legal problem, and the court has to approve the structuring of the case as a class action so that it can go to trial on that basis. And so that's the work that we do. We do plaintiff side class actions. So we're the ones who do the suing. We don't defend these cases. We prosecute them. So okay. It's an interesting thing, and it certainly has a powerful place in the legal system now.
And class actions are growing in Canada?
I think it's fair to say they're really mature now. I'm not sure that growing, they're mm-hmm. still growing. I think they're in quite a mature stage. You hear about them a lot. I mean, if you paid attention after hearing this podcast and watched the ticker on CP24 or listen to the news, you're going to see something about a class action fairly quickly. And so there are many of them, and some of them are transformational. You know, we've got, for example, lately we talk, so much attention has been correctly placed on the First Nations residential schools tragedy. And most of that did originate, the consciousness of that for the Canadian public did originate with a class action in the early 2000s. And I'm ashamed to say most people wouldn't have known outside of First Nations communities, you know, Canadians would not have normally had exposure to it unless something like that had brought it out to the attention of the world. And so there can be some really important impacts out of class action sometimes when there are significant cases like that. So there was a very successful case about residential schools that was a class action case, and that it created awareness in addition to compensation and a number of other things. Not a perfect outcome, no litigation is, but I consider that a transformational example of where class actions can do something really positive.
Yeah, because you can represent almost the little person in the process.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. What's it been like for you working for a big firm versus working in your own boutique firm?
That's a great question too. You know, I enjoyed both. Mm-hmm. In the bigger firm, there's diversity of practice areas, people that do different things than you do, and it's interesting to be with them and to hear what they do and understand how their clients are and, you know, how the economics of their practices work and so on. And so that part's great. I have really enjoyed the boutique side though, because it's so specialized what we do. Everybody here does the same thing. Our focus is really aligned. That was the thing that used to draw on me a little bit at the old firm, was that it was great that there were these different practice areas, but the fact that they were existing in the same place meant there could be tensions between them sometimes. And that could, you know, my practice could be sensitive to those tensions, and so that we feel a bit of stress around that sometimes.
Yeah.
And so in the new firm, we have none of that. We're all running, sprinting in the same direction, as opposed to, thinking about other practice areas. So,
yeah.
There's a nice collegiality here for sure. We're a definite collective. All the people here are all running in the same direction, contributing to the same outcomes. And that's pretty nice. And really, it feels kind of like my track and field days, where you're all on a team together, yeah. Doing the same things, right? So, yeah. So, I mean, big versus small. The social side of that, it's nice to see more people sometimes in the day, but it's also nice to be really close to everybody that you do see.
Yeah. I think too, what must have been kind of great was you could take all those learnings and design what you thought was as close to perfect as possible for yourself and your team.
That's a great observation, because that is true, because I was keeping a list in the back of my head in my former firm of, you know, if I ever had my own place, you know, the things I would want to do and how I would want to structure it so that our practice would function at its best. And that is true. And so when you do your own place, you do write the rules for those sorts of things.
So this show podcast is about career resilience. So how have you had to be resilient in your career, John? What comes to mind for you when you think about resilience?
Resilience is really important. Like, it's a mandatory strength, I think, for this team, the people that I work with here, because our cases are all challenging cases. They all take a long time. They all challenge you in ways that you can't predict at the beginning. Some of our cases, I have one case that I can think of that took us 15 years to resolve.
15 years?
That's a case where I think I explained the other contingency fee cases, which means you're putting all that time and effort in and you don't get paid unless and until you win. And so you have to be resilient to just keep pushing your shovel into the ground, if you know what I mean, just keep working until the case actually resolves without being frustrated, exasperated, or giving up. So all of our cases call on that to some degree. I've joked in the past that for this area, you need a combination of aggression and patience. You have to push, but you also have to know that it's going to take a long time. And so resilience is huge. Like, that's the definition of those things, right? That you have to just keep giving your effort without any certainty as to when that effort's going to bear fruit. Another resilience thing that comes to mind is that this firm, after a careful, I have nothing but praise for my old firm. We took several months to build the separation that we created. And when I created the new firm, and I maintain all my friendships and relationships there. Mm. But we chose to do it. And I eventually chose a start date of March 2nd, 2020. And so we launched on March 2nd, and then on March 17th, the provincial shutdown order came for the COVID-19 pandemic. And so we were literally in our office for 2 weeks before we were told to go home. And so, you make all the investments that are necessary in a new business. You buy all your technology and your servers and your artwork and your everything. And then you can't use the space that you've just launched. And so that was scary, to say the least. Challenging and really uncertain. But somehow or other, the group did extremely well. We all worked from home, worked remotely, and thankfully those computers and phones that we bought were all state of the art, and so they were ready to be switched over to work from home arrangements. And the team here just did a phenomenal job. Like, I could just feel they all took it as a real point of pride that they didn't want to see us have a hard time because we were all forced to work from home. So we ended up having a really fantastic first year in spite of the fact that we were at home for a lot of it.
I think even now, even though it's not really that long ago, John, but I think even now we don't realize the shock of that initial period with COVID and what impact it had on every aspect of our lives. And yeah, just having a new business open, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So you've had many accomplishments in your career, such an impressive career, and yet you've maintained being this great guy at the same time. What are you most proud of that in those accomplishments?
It's funny that you asked that question right now. We were on a group call here yesterday, and I was thinking of all the team members I have here that work in this firm that, you know, you develop people and it's not like you sit and say, you know, I have this plan necessarily for how someone's career is going to work out that works for you. But there isn't a weak link among our group. Like I look around and everybody's so strong and so dedicated and so capable. And I had a moment of like a real flush of like pride just thinking of everybody contributing to their piece on this call. And I thought, I'm pretty lucky that these people are dedicated to this practice and that I've had the chance to do all of this with them. And I guess I must be doing something right if those folks are here with me. And I'm most proud of those people and the fact that they're building great careers here and that this is a great place for them to work. So those are things I feel really proud of when I think about that. And we have team members having babies and, you know, getting married and, so they're thriving in so many ways in life.
Yeah.
And it's nice to see that, you know, they're part of this firm and they're happy and they're proud to be part of it. So those things make me feel probably better than most other things. You know, there's tough career achievements and things that were hard fought to get, and you feel good about those things, but I tend to feel better about the team around me and seeing that they're really doing well and becoming really excellent at what they do.
And John, you know what? That does not happen by accident. Obviously, I know you. I know you as a senior person, and you know, you inspire those things in people. So that's really nice. So in this season of career resilience, I'm going to ask everybody three questions, and I'm going to compile that information and put it on my blog on my website as we go along and just see what the learnings are and what people have to say. So the first question that I had for you is, what has been the best career advice that you have received?
That's an easy one for me. Claude Pensa at the old firm, when I was an Artisan student, he was really good to me. He took me under his wing and we worked on a whole bunch of files very intensely together. And we were dealing with lots of different lawyer types on the other side of the file. Files, and he took me aside at one point. We were in a witness examination somewhere, and there was a difficult thing going on. He said, "There's two types of lawyers in this world. Never forget this. There's problem creators and problem solvers." He said, "Always be the problem solver." And I never forgot that. And it's funny because legal cases are about conflict, and sometimes it's in your client's interest to have things be messy or to have there be a messy conflict that can't be solved, depending on the perspective of the case. And I never accepted that was the way for me. And it was because of Claude's advice that I always thought you should always, always be contributing to solutions rather than contributing to deeper problems. And so I've always said that. I always give that as my advice to the people that join this practice and that work with me. And it's interesting because then you can very quickly see it in practice. If you're dealing with a difficult person on the opposite side of a file, you can tell they're delighting in creating the problem, and you can see how that contrast exists in the law. And Claude was right when he said that to me, that there are some lawyers who thrive on creating problems and making things more difficult. And that isn't the right philosophical approach, at least in his view and mine. And so I always felt that was the best advice, because I think it puts you in good standing wherever you are, if you're always working to try to create solutions rather than add to problems.
Oh, that is excellent, John. Okay, second, is there a book that you've read that influenced you, or an author that you followed that has helped you with your career?
There are lots. One that came up a lot for me, where I kept feeling the lessons of it, was Malcolm Gladwell's book, Outliers. That was the one where he did a brilliant job looking at a really diverse range of people who were excellent at what they did. Could be a hockey player, could be a business person, a musician. Mm-hmm. And he studied them and their history to try and figure out if there were common themes to why they became like outlier quality people. And he came up with a whole bunch of neat sort of thumbnail rules about it that were generally applicable. And I remember one of them was that they had developed 10,000 hours of specialized experience in a relatively early phase of their careers. Mm-hmm. And I remember he had the example of the Beatles played at some, they got a job, like a gig style performance job, where they had to play in a pub from 10 in the morning till like midnight every day. And they had to improvise like crazy, and they had to take requests from the audience. And so they had to gel as a band. They had to understand what each other was contributing to the music. And so he had this thing that through that, when nobody knew who they were, they sort of accumulated these thousands of hours of working together that ended up making them one of the greatest, you know, musical groups in the world. And so I remember I was in my early career, I was working more than 2,000 hours a year. And it was by year five that something started to click, where I really felt strong, I really felt confident, I really felt like I was contributing a lot to the practice and able to make good decisions. And so that one resonated with me, that there were all kinds of neat little lessons. And that's not to say everybody is an outlier or has to be an outlier. It's just an example of patterns in people that, you know, if they want to be good at what they're doing, there are some things that they would do. And the main lesson I took from it was you had to put in some pretty intense work in the early years, and you'd have sort of an exponential strength off of that. So I always love that one. That one came back to me a lot of times.
Oh, that is excellent. Okay, and my other question is, my final of my three is, what advice would you have given or give to, I guess, your younger self?
Yeah, that's a good one too. I think that one for me boils down to stress management. And the way you perceive stress events. I told you the law is about conflict. There's a lot of conflict management that has to go on. And it's easy to become personally drawn into those, measuring yourself against the kinds of conflicts that you get into perpetually. And that can be scary and it can be dark. And I feel like I've handled it relatively well. But when I look back, there are a lot of things I wish I could tell myself at the get-go that I've learned now. Be confident in yourself, keep your cool, even in the face of the really difficult spots, because there's usually an answer. You just have to make good decisions to navigate your way through complicated conflicts and things like that. So the advice I give is you know, really keep your cool. And I have another thought on this too, which is something I've learned about myself, is this kind of law that we practice, it requires it develops something in the lawyers that practice the area where you have to think ahead a lot. You have to anticipate the opponent's moves and the moves that you'll make in response. And that's good on one hand, but on the other hand, it means that you might not be present in the moment so much, because you're always thinking ahead. You're always concerned about the next threat that could come to the file you're working on or whatever. And so I've noticed I had a tendency to develop what I call a two-track mind, which is you're living in a forward thinking track, an anticipatory track, to try to anticipate the things that might come so that you're ready for them. But that has an unhealthy side effect, which means it detracts from your presence in the moment. And so I have a whole bunch of new rules for myself, where I tell myself what my job is now. And my job now is not to think ahead sometimes, right? Yeah. So you need those moments where you say you can turn off the two-track mind. You don't have to be thinking ahead right now. Give yourself instructions not to make that two-track error.
Okay. Those are great pieces. I love all three items. I love what Claude Penza said to you, and that you were able to internalize that. And actually, I think that would reduce some stress to be a problem solver, not a problem creator. I really love that. Malcolm Gladwell, that's a great tip. I like that too. And you're right about, being in the moment and appreciating because it's, you know, we only have this ticket once.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's an important thing to say. John, is there any final words you'd like to say? Anything I didn't ask you that I should have asked you?
No, this has been a lot of fun. I thank you for having me. I think it's great that you're doing this. And I hope this is interesting to your listeners.
Oh, it will be. Thanks. So to our viewers and listeners, thank you so much for joining John and me for this conversation. I hope you enjoy it as much as I've enjoyed it. I really admire John Foreman, and I have from the day I met him. So I hope you do enjoy this. Please follow me on YouTube, subscribe, and listen to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And everything is all housed together on my website, which is career-resilience.com. So thank you for joining us, and until we meet again.